Legislative Advisory Commission will come to order. The weather did good for us today. Nobody has to feel bad. It's cool and cloudy. Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling the meeting back together. We are following up on where the continued discussion of the proposed unallotments. There is a series of memos that have gone back and forth, requests by commission members, responses by the Office of Management and Budget, and I think we'll dig into that. Commissioner, why don't you just briefly, you have decided to recommend some changes to the governor than what we first heard about. Perhaps it would be wise to just summarize that first. They're not major changes, but there are some changes.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just to lay the foundation, we ended the last meeting with a number of questions. If you recall, Representative Sertich did a pretty capable job, and what we did, we ended up our letter of June 25th. I think we crossed in the night. We answered a number of questions, and then you sent us a letter the same day, and then we responded. But in the June 25th letter, and I think it also is made available, there are primarily a number of changes to human services and one change from the Department of Revenue. And then I guess the letter of the 29th.
This is the reduced county medical health grants, children's community service grants. This is the 25th letter?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think the major change.
Grants. Go ahead.
The major change would be, and I think it's probably in the 25th letter, is our backing off of the transitional health care with other modifications. And I can have, we can have at your indulgence, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Ludeman, go through.
Why don't we see by question whether, rather than going through every detail, let's see if by question our key chairs in that area. Senator Berglund, did you have questions about those changes or thoughts? Senator Berglund?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Ludeman?
But and Mr. Chair, just one, the fact that we backed off on transitional health care required some of the other modifications, which is why you see a number of them.
Senator Berglund?
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I would like to just ask a few questions about the outreach unallotment. We were going to have a hearing with you to discuss this before it was actually implemented, but now that you're moving it up to January, I don't think we'll be able to do that. So is it your intention that entities that are assisting in outreach will only receive the bonus if someone that they assist is enrolling in Minnesota Care? Is that the effect of what you're doing?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Cal Ludeman, Commissioner of Human Services, and Senator Berglund. As you know, the outreach portion of the Health Care Access Fund outreach funding is not changed by this unallotment. Most of that would be used then for proper enrollment and outreach for Minnesota Care.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, maybe I didn't make my question clear. The question was, will people only be receiving the bonus when an enrollee that they assist is enrolling in Minnesota Care?
Madam Chairman, I believe that would be how we would implement the continued funding for outreach from the Health Care Access Fund. It would be a successful enrollment in Minnesota Care.
So you wouldn't be using Minnesota Care as a bonus for people being enrolled in Medicaid?
Not any different than we currently do, Madam Chairman.
And then if a person is eligible for Medicaid, you would be enrolling them in Medicaid per your agreement with the federal government?
That's correct, Madam Chairman.
So that is correct. Then I guess the last part of the question in regard to this issue is that we'd like still to get a detailed fiscal analysis of how the unallotments in general will affect the Health Care Access Fund, both for general assistance medical care and for any other part of the unallotments that might be affecting the health care access fund. Would that be possible?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, yes, it would be possible, although, as you know, with the transitional Minnesota Care not being on this list anymore, we would project that the effect on the health care access fund will not be dramatic, but we'll get you every analysis of what that would mean.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Mr. Senator. Chairman, I have just one other area of question for the commissioner that I didn't bring up last week because we were not aware of it. But in the letter that we received, I believe yesterday, you said that the methamphetamine grants would not be unallotted.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, Senator.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, when we make an appropriation for a broad number of grants like that, I guess I'm not sure that you have the authority to pick and choose which ones you unallot. You could unallot all of them, as you had said you were going to, or you could ratably reduce, you know, unallot some portion of it. But when you start picking and choosing which grants to unallot, I believe then you're entering the realm of making a policy decision. And I guess my own feeling is that unallotment statute does not give the governor that authority. On what basis do you believe you have the authority to make that decision?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, on the issues of the authority that the governor has that changes obligations in the unallotment authority, we're simply going to stand by what we believe that interpretation of changing those obligations are, whether they're in statute or administratively. The challenges to the unallotment statute will be somewhere else, perhaps. Commissioner Hansen can speak to that. We believe this would not be the only area, for example.
Well,
the
no, the white earth.
Yes.
Reinstating white earth, picking one tribe over other tribes when we make an appropriation for all of those areas of child welfare, I think, is another questionable area.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, it isn't that you pick one over another. It's simply if dollars are unallotted, how do you actually apportion those unallotments or reductions? And there has to be a way to do it. One of the ways is to preserve a total grant, for example, for the White Earth Ojibwe tribe for that pilot project and for specific reasons, had reasons for that saving from unallotment. That was a administrative decision that we did make in this unallotment decision.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to summarize my feelings about this, when we make an appropriation, you have the right to unallot that appropriation. I don't believe you have the right to go in and pick and choose within that appropriation what part of it you will unallot and what part of it you will not.
Okay.
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, 16A-152, subdivision B, gives us the authority to unallot. And then in the latter part of that paragraph, the commissioner is empowered to defer or suspend priorly created statutory obligations. And then as you look down even further, and I think it's subdivision D and reducing allotments, the commissioner may consider other sources of revenue available to recipients. It gives us broader, from our view, and I realize that we're probably going to end up disagreeing, but in our view, that gives us the authority to go in and determine which grants we can allot and leave some of them.
Madam Speaker.
Commissioner, I don't have a lot of questions for you today. I think other members are going to be asking you a lot of questions that have been raised either by your letters or by the governor's, your and the governor's actions. But I am going to say for the record that I believe that you and the governor have taken the unallotment statute far too far. And in fact, I believe it is going to be necessary for the legislature to change the law next year to modernize the unallotment law in accordance with what other states do. no one, I think, could have imagined before this point that a governor would veto a balanced budget bill in order to go unilaterally and go it alone in balancing this budget. And so I think it's very necessary at this point to put on the record that there will be a bill. There already have been two bills introduced, but I believe there will be a bill that legislators bipartisanly can hopefully support. So this never happens again, whether the governor is a Democrat or a Republican or an independent. This has been a move that I believe is out of step and illegal in many aspects. We will maybe never know if it is not challenged in court. But I do think the legislature must retain the power the legislature has to change the law. And I think it is necessary to say that at this point, that it is absolutely imperative that the legislature curb the power of a chief executive in terms of infringing on the legislative powers of the state. I, for one, believe in a democracy. I believe in a democracy with three strong branches of government, and I believe that the governor's actions impinge on the legislative branch and, in fact, actually weaken the relationship between the executive-legislative branch relationship. And so I, for one, will be a strong sponsor and will be encouraging all of my colleagues to vote for changes in the on-allotment law going forward, because we, I think many of us, believe bipartisanly that this has gone way too far.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, that's a, you know, how we discuss and change the law is an issue for the next legislative session. As far as going at it alone, I think the governor has been very clear. It was very clear when we introduced our budget in January what our preference was, and that we weren't going to raise taxes and that we wanted to reprioritize and how we wanted to solve the budget. We had ideas to mitigate some of these cuts that you rejected. We did this in midweek before the final Monday, and you chose to go ahead anyway, and in the last 8 minutes of the legislative session in both bodies, in an untransparent manner, roll right over both minorities and pass your balanced budget that passed in the last 8 minutes of a five-month legislative session. I don't think...
Madam Speaker.
Well, Commissioner, thank you for rewriting history for everyone in the room. The fact of the matter is, the only thing that had never been passed to the governor before the final night of session was the school shift. Every single other thing had been passed to the governor ahead of time. Oh, with the exception of the business tax cuts that were included in the bill, which had passed both bodies. There is no truth to your statement. No truth to your statement at all. This is a governor who on the Thursday before the end of session stood up and declared he had made a decision to unallot himself. It is quite different than the previous two sessions, one where we had a surplus and one where we had a deficit, where we spent inordinate amounts of time with this governor. The governor disengaged. The governor disengaged early. It is accurate and it is truthful. The legislature passed a balanced budget. The governor chose to veto the balanced budget. Commissioner, how many other states have been in this situation and decided to raise taxes this year?
Madam Speaker, before I get to that question, I said you didn't pass a balanced budget till the final 8 minutes. You passed other budget bills. And if you go back...
Well, I think, Commissioner...
No, no.
Thank you.
I think you were editorializing, Commissioner, about transparency.
Am I going to get interrupted, Mr. Chairman, the whole time whenever I speak? Or am I going to be allowed to speak? What I'm saying
Commissioner, you may have a lot of power, but you can't tell the chairman of a committee how to run the committee. Now, you will have an opportunity to speak.
I was speaking.
But by the time this meeting's over, Commissioner, you will not only have been treated fairly, but you will have been treated honestly. Madam Speaker first, then the Commissioner.
Commissioner, if our quibble is about when the bill was passed, let's be very clear. The rules of the House are made to be used to govern, not to gum up the works. I have experienced the minority twice in my tenure as Speaker as trying to gum up the works by the use of the rules at the end of a session. The only piece of the balanced budget that had not previously been passed to the governor was the school shift. That is the only piece. Everything else, how we cut deeper in the general fund budget than the governor and passed and the governor signed into law, that is a fact. How we worked with your commissioners to use the one-time money appropriately from the federal government, that is a fact. That we passed to the governor of the state, the chief executive of the state, a balanced budget by our constitutionally appointed midnight deadline on the last day of a session, that is a fact. You may have an opinion about how that looked, but the minority shares a role in how that looked as well by their behaviors and actions.
Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, if you look back at the, and I was standing there on that day when the governor made his announcement that this was a possibility, that unallotment. I mean, you look back at what he said, it wasn't the, he didn't make the decision then. It was only made after the legislative session concluded. We still were trying to negotiate, but we were making it clear the ramifications of not coming to an agreement in those final 5 days.
Madam Speaker.
Commissioner, you are allowed to tell yourself whatever you believe. That is not the facts, though. The facts are that I wrote a letter to the governor within moments of his press conference asking him to detail the detail of the unallotment offer. He wrote me a very brief one-paragraph letter back that has a very clear sentence in it, Commissioner, and I will have it brought over right now. That sentence was, this is not an offer, this is a decision.
When session,
Commissioner, then we're going to move on.
All right, Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, it was a decision that we weren't going into special session, and we had to conclude by that Monday. That's what I remember it as being.
Well, it's, you know, with all due respect to the executive branch, you don't have all of those powers, but let's move on. Senator Bach, Lencheski, there's one change here on the property tax refunds. What do we know about this, Senator Bach?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe this is for Commissioner Ines. I saw him in the room earlier. Commissioner, I have a question on the additional $5.7 million that you indicate is being expended because of increased property tax refunds and a reduction in state corporate and individual income tax receipts. Of the $5.7 million, how does that break out? How much is additional refund payments to homeowners, and then how much is less revenue from corporations and individuals? Do we have a breakdown on that?
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Bach, I believe the PTR impact is about $4.8 million. I'll verify that, but I'm pretty sure the remainder is the income tax interactions. And last time we were in front of the commission, we did not have the secondary impacts of the unallotment decision. So in my area, it's the PTR impacts, and as you know, Chairman, the individual income tax impacts. And that's,
okay. Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, remind me then, what is the anticipated property tax increase we're going to see that lead to the additional refunds? How much of a property tax increase are we going to see?
For the first, Chairman, Senator Bach, for the first year, we anticipate a $68 million property tax increase, and we use the historical assumptions of two-thirds levy back. And then the following year, I believe it's $170 million, Senator Bach.
Okay. Commissioner, about $238 million?
Chairman, Senator Bach, that is correct.
In a property tax increase?
Yep, over the two-year time
okay.
frame.
Thank you.
Correct.
Commissioner, on this letter that you signed, I just want to, on an accuracy issue, you said that there's no tax increases. Memo that you signed
The reduction in aids to local governments are assumed to result in property tax increases. You signed the memo. Those are your words. You need to stop saying there are no tax increases. I think that's just
Chairman,
a factual matter. Yeah, I got to stop saying that.
Where are you looking?
It's on page two, bottom of your June 25th memo. The reductions in aids to local governments are assumed to result in property tax increases. We all know that. You have said it in a memo. So I think you just need to stop saying there are no tax increases. Okay, let's move on.
Did Lanchesky have
And Senator Representative Lanchesky, anything further on this issue or no?
Back later. You're just on the changes that the commissioner brought forward? No.
Okay.
Thanks.
Okay, then why don't we go to Representative you had issues on the data regards to jobs, and I think Mr. Stinson's done some work, so yeah. Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if Commissioner Hansen could stay up as well, and maybe this would be a good time for Mr. Stinson as well. I know Dr. Stinson, I'm sorry. You have a better title, I think, than many of us around the table. Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson and Commissioner Hansen, I sent a fairly detailed letter with a number of questions that were detailed. I didn't get responses to all of the questions, and I asked for them in advance of the meeting so that we could go through the data. You did grab me right before this meeting started and said that Dr. Stinson was working on the jobs aspect of it, and I appreciate that. There are still other questions that are left unanswered in my letter. We don't need to go through those piece by piece right now. I would just appreciate that information in it. You know, I numbered them so that you could keep track of them. If I could get that in writing at some point, that would be helpful. But I know that Dr. Stinson probably has a presentation on these job numbers that were included in our packet, and then I would have some questions afterwards, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Tom Stinson, state economist, and I'm here this morning to respond to Representative Sertich's questions. I think there are four questions about the jobs impact at the top of your memo. Before I skip to the bottom line, let me tell you how we did this. I apologize it took longer than we thought. I was out of town, and we just really didn't get everything firmed up until yesterday. Otherwise, we wanted to have it to you by Friday, but we just didn't get everything firmed. The way we approached the problem was in a little bit more detail than the quick method that the budget director went through, although the differences aren't really very large in terms of the answer, and so that was reassuring to us. What we did was we divided the proposed unallotments into three major categories: those directly affecting the level of state and local government spending, for example, the 2.25% agency cuts or the $300 million in local government aids and credits reduction. A second group was changes in human services spending that would be passed on to private sector or nonprofit operations. It would be really a direct cut to them. It's just passed through human services. And then the third part was the shifts or payment delays. We estimated the impacts as follows. For the direct public sector impacts, we used something called a revenue receipts jobs elasticity. And what that really is that's a complicated way of saying that we assume that, we didn't assume, but there is a general recognition that a proportionate increase or decrease in the receipts of local government produces an equal proportionate level of employment increase or decrease. The Council of Economic Advisors in their, the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors in their report on the stimulus package used that as a way of estimating it. We actually went into the Global Insight model, that the national macroeconomic model that we use, and found the equation that Global Insight uses to forecast local government, state and local government.
Dr. Stinson, could you speak up a little?
Sure.
Bring it a little closer to
state and local government employment, and they use the same relationship, and so we felt comfortable with that. And what that says is if there's a 1% increase or decrease in the receipts going to state and local government, employment increases by 1% or decreases by 1%. The second part of the unallotment, second piece of the unallotments was the impact on human service providers in the private sector. And there we took the percentage change in Minnesota's human services spending as a total, not just state government, but all, used that same percentage change in the national economic model that we have, the global insight model that we had, and then found the change that came out of that. And so this is very consistent with the model that we use to estimate the impacts on the U.S. economy and the Minnesota economy in February. And then the third piece is the shift. Here we focused on the revenue lost either because of foregone interest payments drawing down cash balances or because of short-term loans that would have had been taken out by the school districts. We estimated that. Then we used that change, that dollar change, and found that percentage dollar change and used that then in the same way with that revenue elasticity that we had.
Representative
Rich? Yeah, I think he's still going.
Okay.
In some instances, it's possible to do the job elasticity in two ways. You can look at the total jobs or you can look at the jobs in that particular sector, and we did both of those, and so it gives us a range in there. The range is appropriate since the way that individual managers and administrators choose to deal with the problem is going to produce different in there. The range is not particularly large, however, and so we felt real comfortable with it. The estimates were based on the proposed list of unallotments that were given dated June 16th. As everybody knows, they've changed slightly, but we don't think that there would be a material difference in the estimates of the employment. There are some key assumptions that are required. The first is that the job elasticity, the receipts job elasticity that we're using is the same for Minnesota as the national average. It seems reasonable. The second may not be true, but we didn't know what else to do, and that is that the jobs elasticity is the same for a cut in spending as an increase in spending. It might be that you would behave differently if spending was cut than if spending was increased. So, but we have to assume that symmetry. Third, we assumed that school districts can borrow or lend at the same interest rate. We deliberately chose a 4% interest rate, which is a little bit high, but we wanted to be sure that we didn't understate the impact on school districts. And then these are only the direct losses. These are not what are called the indirect losses or the losses that are due that occur because of suppliers losing business, and they're not the induced or multiplier losses as well. If you want to expand this to include the indirect and induced losses, you would multiply the number by about 50%. So if we've got 3,000, it would be like 4,500, or 4,500, it would be like 5,750.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, so what you're saying is this is more the floor than the ceiling of assumptions here as far as the job loss, without those other factors that are admittedly a lot harder to calculate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, yes, although the problem and the reason why these numbers are kind of ambiguous is there are large leakages. The books that would not necessarily have been printed might not have been printed in Minnesota, so we might be exporting some of those job losses to places where the books are printed or things like that. And so, you know, you can go ahead and say that these are two-thirds of what the actual losses would be, but the hard number that would be these direct losses.
Thanks.
Okay, now getting to the bottom line, we find prospective job losses of between 3,300 and 4,700 due to the governor's unallotment. To put this in perspective, that's about 1/8 of 1% or 1/6 of 1% of Minnesota employment. It's somewhere between 1/3 and 1/2 as much as we've lost in jobs over the last 2 months. It's almost twice the number of jobs that we lost statewide in the month of May. About 40% of the job losses are in local government, non-school. It's about 1% of non-school local governments. 300 to 600 of the jobs are in the local education sector. Your question asked how many are teachers, and that's something that we just can't respond to because it could be professional personnel, it could be playground supervisors and things like that. But sure, somewhere between 300 and 600 jobs are lost in the K-12. Somewhere between 870 and 1,630 jobs are lost in state government. Again, you ask about university teachers or university professors, and again, we can't give you that kind of information, although our suspicion is that at the university level that this would be the larger the number is at the university level, the more likely it is to be things like student employment, where you just don't hire as many students for part-time work, which, of course, makes it much more difficult for students to afford school. About 500 jobs in the private health care and social services area, or about 1/10 of 1% of the employment in there. We also use the Global Insight model to estimate the number of jobs lost from a tax increase in there. And what we found was if for a $1 billion tax increase, $500 million each year of a biennium, it would cost about 1,000 jobs. And so these are, of course, very difficult times, and there are very difficult choices that have to be made in there, and there really aren't any good answers or acceptable answers.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, I appreciate that because that you actually anticipated what my first question was going to be. And either you're quiet or the microphone's not quite loud, and I just want to make sure I heard that correctly, that you did do some assumptions on what a tax increase would cost as far as jobs in the state, and with Governor Pawlenty's unallotments and these cuts, it would be somewhere between 3,000 and almost 5,000 jobs, 4,700. I have to be more precise when I'm talking to economists, I believe. You just said, I think, that a tax increase right around the level that the legislature was discussing would have been only 1,000 jobs lost. Did I hear you correctly on that?
Yeah. We used the Global Insight model to estimate what the job loss that would be accompany an income tax increase of roughly $1 billion, $500 million in fiscal 2010, $500 million in 2011, and it came out to cost about 1,000 jobs. So a rough rule of thumb is $1 billion over 2 years would cost 1,000 jobs, $500 million over 2 years would cost 500 jobs.
Okay. Well, then, I'm going to eventually have a question for Commissioner Hansen, where if they took this into account, that Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal is going to cost 3 to 5 times as many job loss in the state than the legislative proposal looks like it would have. So if you want to think about that response, Commissioner Hansen. But Dr. Stinson, I tried to do some homework on this too, and maybe you're familiar with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities piece that they put out, that, you know, 75% of states have either passed or are looking at revenue as an option of balancing a state budget. Within the document that they produced, they do recognize, as Commissioner Hansen has in his memo, that even under Governor Pawlenty's plan, taxes are going to rise, and that's a part of this piece. But it also talks about getting out of the recession or getting out of these rough economic times, that states that do increase revenue, for the most part, and almost mirror the states that cut only as far as growing out of these rough economic times. Can you comment on that as well, if you're familiar with that, or how that data would be the same or different in Minnesota if we went a different path than what the governor is proposing here, how we would recover out of this rough economic time for our state?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, I am not familiar with the details of the Center of Budget and Policy Priorities or Budget Policy and Priorities analysis. You know, to me, the issue is one of what happens 2 years from now or a year and a half from now. There's not any difference really in a temporary tax or you'll have to solve the problem if you have a temporary tax. If you have a permanent tax, you don't have to solve the problem. But I don't know quite understand why the where the estimates came from the Center of Budget and Priorities. Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, and I guess Commissioner Hansen, why would Governor Pawlenty? I mean, we can quibble about when a bill was passed on which day of session. And look in hindsight, or we can do the rhetoric back and forth. And I heard from the governor actually before the previous LAC meeting said, the reason you're going down this path is because the legislature's path would have cost more jobs. And maybe that was just, you know, and I don't even think it was the governor, it was his spokesperson, so maybe he had it wrong. But, you know, getting data, hard data from our economist states that your proposal, Governor Pawlenty's proposal, is going to cost 3 to 5 times as many job loss in the state than the legislature's proposal would have projected. So, you know, like I said, quibble about the semantics about when a bill was passed or not, or who spoke on what time, or who's going to be treated fairly. Isn't the big deal about this jobs? And why would we want to, why would you want to propose, and why would you look to the LAC to endorse more job loss under your proposal than the legislative proposal?
Matt, Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, first I want to compliment Dr. Stinson and our other economists, Matt Scheppner. They've been holed up in Dr. Stinson's office around the clock responding to your challenge. I felt I got a little bit of a glimpse over the course of the week, but got my first big look at it now. I guess my comments you know, from what I heard him, Dr. Stinson say, that it is difficult. It is I saw how many hours he put into it, you know, so there's a lot of variables. My first point, I think that in the broader perspective, having the fourth highest income tax in the country, taxing liquor and the surcharge on credit, the items that were in our in the $1 billion tax bill that you passed put us out of context, out of competition for jobs in the longer term than, in my opinion, as we go forward, as we try to grow out of this recession.
As Commissioner of Finance or Commissioner of Revenue or what? In your opinion, as what? What expertise do you bring to the table, Commissioner of Finance, on that point?
Mr. Chairman, I am the Commissioner of Management and Budget, the Chief Financial Officer of the state of Minnesota, as defined by statute, confirmed by the Senate.
And you work for all of us.
I am. It is our view in this administration that the governor's plan will put us in a better position to recover from this recession. We haven't said it wouldn't hurt in the interim.
Representative Sertich.
Commissioner. Your opinion and rhetoric might not matter as much than, you know, we're talking about a very credible source here. The Center of Budget and Policy Priorities has actually looked at this, looked at previous years where budgets were in deficit in times of recession and depression. And I'd be happy to share this with you. I would hope that this would be data that you would look at. The source is the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and looks at states and looks at the annual economic growth by various indicators on states that increase taxes significantly and the national average. And whether you talk about total personal income, whether you talk about employment or medium wage, the factors are identical as far as growth out of these rough economic times. So we can deal with opinion and rhetoric all we want. I'm glad Dr. Stinson is here so we can deal with facts. So we know that under your proposal, Governor Plenty's proposal, the job loss is going to be 3 to 5 times that of the legislature and the bill he vetoed to put us out of balance. And that your opinion is not shared by national economists and others who have actually studied this issue that says that if we went with a balanced approach, we would both stabilize our budget into the future and that we'd actually grow at a rate and be just as competitive as every other state.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, I have a little bit of concern about the school district numbers here. When I looked at the estimate of 300 to 600, it triggered something for me about some work that the Association of Metropolitan School Districts did during session. And as I'm remembering this, the association, and that's just the Metropolitan School District, so they went out and looked at the legislative proposals and their effect on jobs in school districts, just in the metropolitan area. So Senator Baca didn't even include what would happen in rural areas to schools across our state. And their estimate was, at this level of shift, the job loss in just metropolitan school districts, the member school districts of that, of AMSD, is 825 job losses. So I don't know if you looked at that information. We've been on the phone to their folks over at AMSD right now to get confirmation. They have confirmed that the number at that level of school shift, and of course we would maintain that the big difference between the legislative proposal and the governor's actions and the commissioner's actions here are that there is no plan to pay back these school districts. There's nothing in statute that means that they're getting paid back. And so I think that I would just note that a source that looked at just the Association of Metropolitan School Districts said the job loss for school districts is 825 under this similar type of proposal, and that doesn't even look at the rural school districts. So my guess is the estimate of 300 to 600 may be a little low.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, we did the following. We took the estimated, the amount that it was to be shifted for 2010. We apportioned it using the payment schedule. So every 15, July 15th, you get 5% of your money. July 30th, you get an additional 2.5%, so on like that. We computed the interest at a 4% rate that would be lost or that you would have to pay for that for the entire year plus the following year. And those seem to me to be very conservative assumptions. First of all, the 4% rate seems to be a little bit higher than I would expect. We have some material that indicated that more recent borrowing was at a 3.3% rate. Second, it's my understanding that the interest costs that districts would not incur interest costs for a full year, but rather just for part of a year when they had a short-term cash flow problem. And my understanding is that practice is that school districts borrow for 13 months when they borrow short-term. And so they would be able to offset some of that with other interest earnings for part of the time. And so I think our estimate is a good estimate. Now, there's not a lot of difference in economic terms between an 800 estimate and a 600 estimate when we're talking about these things. But I'm very comfortable with the assumptions that we made, and we made them trying to be conservative in there.
I just, Mr. Chair and Dr. Stinson, I respect you a great deal, and I just want to note for the record that there was at least another set of data that legislators had received during the session. And if you consider that that number was just the those members of the Metropolitan School Districts Association, that number is even low then, because at 825, it doesn't include what's going to happen in the rural school districts. And so I think it's important to note it at this point.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, does your number for local government and others include the property tax increase as well? Is that reflected in the job loss, or would that be in addition to, since there's a property tax increase, would we add more job loss onto?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, it does not include any local government changes, but that the way the elasticity works is that if local governments increase their property tax, then that increases receipts, and so that would offset some of the job loss by increasing the property tax. So this is a worst case scenario, that the jobs that would be lost if local governments did not increase their property taxes to make up some of that local government aid loss.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Stinson, would that be a shift then for job loss if there was a tax increase to the private sector or other sectors?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, yes, you're right.
Okay.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask a few more questions of Commissioner Ludeman, if I might.
On health care? Anything else on jobs right now? Representative Sergeant.
Mr. Chair, just so that folks get the data, as you know, we heard a lot of opinions from Commissioner Hansen. I'm getting copied at least a portion of the Center on Budget Policy Priorities document on this, on balanced state budgets. I'm going to try to get the whole document for at least the members on this commission and for Commissioner Hansen. But I just at least copied out that piece about the balanced approach versus what is going on. And the piece I left out because I didn't wanted Commissioner Hansen to see it in black and white, but it's still getting copied, is interestingly enough, when you look at jobs again, it states in that document that states that did not raise taxes or cut them during the last recession saw slower than average economic growth. And one of the states that they used as an example for that was Minnesota. And I think we saw that as well when Governor Plenty himself put out the data and information that Minnesota is, I think, ranked 36th in job growth in his 7 years as governor of the state. And there's now data available, not opinions, but data available that shows potentially a reason for that. And I didn't just want to throw that out there without backing it up, Commissioner, but it seems we're moving along. I'm going to get that data to you, the members of the commission, and the members of the public as well.
Mr. Chairman, just one quick question for Dr. Stinson. The numbers you talked about were 1/6 to 1/8 of 1%
That's
of the
correct.
Employment? 1/6 to 1/8. Now, while on every job, we're not talking about something that is moving the entire workforce in our state.
Commissioner Hansen, though, but if it was your job, it's 100% of your job is lost.
I understand.
So you can try to play the facts and the figures and the fractions. When we deal with unemployment in the state, we're worried an uptick of 0.1% or 0.1%. So I wouldn't minimize 3,000 to 5,000 jobs lost in the state, because that's 100% of that person's job that's lost.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, not my intent at all, but as policymakers and leaders of our state, having the perspective of 1/6 to 1/8 is 3,000 is a lot. One's a lot. But 1/6 to 1/8 of 1% is also a figure that's important too.
But on top of 8.2% is the issue. It's on top of a high number.
Yeah, it is.
We're going the wrong direction, I think, is the point Representative Sertich is trying to make. We're going the wrong direction.
Yes.
We should try to be going, bringing that number down, not up.
I agree.
So, Senator Bergen, before you, on the 25th memo, I just wanted to point out also, Commissioner Revenue, thank you so much for pointing out on the back page of the Appendix C, the history of major tax percent shares. You can clearly see the point that's being made by numerous observers that property tax is overtaking all the other taxes. And you can see that in the music business, they would call that with a bullet. Property taxes rising with a bullet. Senator Bach, on that point.
On the property tax issue, and this might be, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, this might be a question for Dr. Mulcher, but I'm just wondering if in any of the assumptions on the school aid cut, delay, shift, whatever we're going to call it, I guess, are there any assumptions built into that school there's going to be an uptick in the number of excess operating referendums that school districts might propose with this uncertain future? And what would be, if there is, what percentage of them might pass, what kind of assumptions were made, what would be the property tax impact of that, what would be the additional state cost of equalization of those referendums? Was any of that considered, that schools may look to more voter-approved operating referendums as a result of the delay in the payments?
Do you want to sit down?
Do you have something on that, or is something you could calculate for us?
I think she's going to. They haven't built it into.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, I'm Michelle Weber with the Department of Education. We have not built that into any of the assumptions.
I think to the extent that you could do some work on that, I think that'd be helpful. I think both tax chairs would like that. Okay. Normal course, you do get calculations on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do think facing this uncertain future, and I think schools need to be aware that this is going to be very, very difficult for the next legislature to pay back, facing a significant deficit in addition to the school payment delay, that we may see a significant uptick in the number of voter-approved levies that are going to be run. So I think if the department could get us some information on that, those of us in the tax area would be, and I'm sure those in the education area would be very interested in that.
Okay, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Ludeman, I had asked a question last week that wasn't answered, and so since we have enough time, I'm going to ask it again. On your list of unallotments, you have called one of them increasing the managed care withhold, and I think we all agreed last week that you don't have the authority to appropriate money to repay this, so the question was, if you withhold or if you cut the managed care contracts by that amount, will that meet the actuarial soundness standard that the federal government requires of us?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, that was a good question. The withholds are sort of a rolling forward obligation, contract obligation for those. You know exactly how withholds work. The actuarial soundness question is a question that can only be answered if you take the entire scope of all the payments and any other policy changes that affect managed care plans. So when you take a managed care plan, a company, and look at their entire book of business, when you look at all of those payments, that's when you would measure the test of actuarial soundness. So we have not went back to our actuary on any increase in the withhold based on this unallotment to make that measure. We would have to go back and recalculate all of the book of business that managed care has with our entire public programs system to measure whether we are now within the bounds of what is called actuarial soundness, which is a requirement of by CMS.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, when do you plan to do that?
Well, when the unallotments begin, we would then start to do the work company by company to make sure that, by that I mean managed care organization, to make sure that within that entire scope of their entire business, we have met the standards of actuarial soundness. We would do that as soon as we're taking the actions.
Commissioner, my understanding is that once the governor makes this unallotment cut, it cannot be restored. So you're going to determine whether it's actuarially sound after you have the unallotment be finalized?
Mr. Speaker, Senator Berglund, actually, yes, that is how we do it. Actually, that is how we do it even with the passage of legislation. We test this after the fact with CMS and are usually generally confident. We've never been in violation on actuarial soundness yet. So we test this after the fact and take that measure.
Well, Commissioner, as you know, we struggle with this during the session when we're making reductions as well. And we were told by your department last session when we were looking at ways to reduce the budget that an 8% withhold would not meet the actuarial soundness test. And then somehow, right at the end of the session, the actuary said, wait a minute, maybe it would. And so we did 8%. Now you're doing 9.5. And, I mean, you know, it's only fair to us to have correct information during the session when we're making decisions. The information that we were given during the session clearly implied that 9.5 would not be actuarially sound. So if now all of a sudden it is actuarially sound, I am mystified at how actuarial soundness is determined by your department, and if it's based on one criteria one day and another criteria another day, or how it is decided that an action of the legislature or of the governor would be actuarially sound or not.
I think an overall theme here that commission members are concerned about with regards to additional inpatient hospital payment delays, additional non-patient acute payment delays, delayed continuing care grants, and increased managed care withholdings, I think legislators believe those cannot be delayed. Those are really cuts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really one of the things that's kind of, Commissioner, I think that's what you kind of keep hearing in terms of some of these items. In actuality, those appear to be cuts, not delays, because of things like Senator Berglund's talking about. That, I think that's kind of a summary of those.
Mr. Chairman, and I would also not belabor that point. It looks like a reduction. It feels like one. And we would have to work with the legislature to undo whether we call it a delay.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, on another item, Commissioner, the unallotment of general assistance medical care. The governor sent a letter to us right before the end of the session as he had vetoed the general assistance medical care appropriation, saying he hoped to work with the legislature to modify general assistance medical care and to not just leave the veto standing. Now we've had an unallotment that moves it up to March. So my question is, what is the date that you would have to send out notices to enrollees that their care would be discontinued?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, it would be 10 days before the 1st of March. I would remind you that even with the line item veto, we would have had to send those notices 10 days before the 1st of April.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I understand that, but the legislature doesn't go back into session until February 6th. So how many days do we have to, quote, unquote, work together to try to fix this?
We would have precious little time if we waited till the legislative session started. Senator, but we do have July, August, September, October, November, December.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, when would the last date that a payment would go out to a provider for general assistance medical care, and will you be sending out notices to them also, and when would that notice need to go out?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, I'm not sure if notices are required. I think the payments are made, and they would be paid potentially up to the last day of June. It would be the last day of May, I believe. Oh, that would work. Yeah, any claim that a provider has a claim in for up to February 28th would be paid, and it would be paid as long as the appropriation is there for that payment. Also included in this period of time between March 1st and July 1st is a $19 million withhold payment for calendar year 09 to managed care organizations by contract, which also would have to come out of the current appropriation of 2010. So the claims, we assume, would all be paid before July 1st.
Well,
Senator,
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, I guess what I'm trying to say to you is it doesn't feel like the offer of the governor to try to fix his veto was very genuine when on top of that we have an unallotment that gives us almost no time to fix it. I mean, even if before February 6th everybody figured this out, we still just logistically do not have very many days to pass legislation in both bodies and have it signed by the governor. And I can only assume that making that unallotment was a signal to us that the governor really doesn't care very much about whether this gets fixed.
Well,
Commissioner, do you want to say something to that?
Yeah, I'll just get no.
Okay.
I'll
get
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund, and we need to move on.
I have just then one comment to make to Commissioner Hansen, and that is that we both know that the state is not going to be out of money before the next legislative session. The purpose and the intention of the unallotment law is to make sure that the state doesn't run out of money. So by unallotting at this time, I believe that you're preempting the power of the legislature to correct any budget deficit that we have next session. And I believe that your action is premature.
Okay, Commissioner and members would like to move to this sheet. Remember, Mr. Mossman had done a budget sheet last week estimating the impact of this on 12 and 13. The commissioner has given us some feedback on this. We appreciate that. And I think, Commissioner, this reflects the number you'd like to work with, the $4.4 billion, 12 and 13. That does not include the $888 million of GMAC tails, and I think everybody pretty much agrees there's going to be a tail there of some sort. And then on the property tax recognition accounting change, let me just ask if we've got our information correct. At staff level, we've been told that the intent is for you or the governor to tell the Commissioner of Education to basically change the accounting method from accrual method to a cash method with regards to the property tax recognition. Is that correct? Is that what you and do you intend to do that, or does the governor or does the Commissioner of Education believe she has that authority on her own to basically change the way to count the books?
As we have, Mr. Chairman, as we have stated in our letter of June 25th, we spelled out specifically the statutory authority, but it's in essence recognizing the June or the May payment in the year it's collected rather than in the next biennium. Then you're getting three payments in 1 year, and then we would unallot the one.
Okay, Commissioner, but the way to effectuate that apparently is to change from accrual method of accounting to cash accounting. Is that the way you're going to effectuate that? That's what we've been told at the staff level. And we want to know if you have who has the authority to do that.
That would be the Commissioner of Education.
So you are going to somebody going to direct the commissioner to do that, or do I need to ask the commissioner if that's her idea, or is someone going to direct her to do that? It's okay, Ms. Weber. I'll ask the commissioner personally.
Well, I think the governor.
Are you going to direct her, or is she going to do it on her own?
Well, the governor has directed her.
Has directed her to change the accounting method from accrual to cash.
The governor has directed her to mimic the effects of the property tax recognition shift, as we spelled out in our June 25th letter.
So the governor has directed the Commissioner of Education to mimic the recognition shift by changing the accrual method, the accounting method, from accrual to cash. Cook the books, basically. Maybe you wouldn't like me to refer to as cook the books, but they are going to change the accounting method. Is that correct?
Well, Senator or Mr. Chairman, it's the proposal you passed on the last night of session.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
It's the property tax recognition shift.
With a legislative authority, not to cook the books. with an accounting shift.
The effect
with an
is
accounting method. It mimics, right?
Right, right. You disagree with the method, but the effect is the same as what you had, what the House had passed as part of their original budget proposal, which you compromised with them on the last night of session.
Commissioner Finance, I think I understand that difference. I am asking you, as a professional and as the Commissioner of Finance that has been confirmed by the State Senate, do you believe the Commissioner of Education should accept the direction of the Governor to change the accounting method from accrual to cash in the middle of a period? Do you think that's a wise thing to do as a Commissioner of Finance?
Mr. Chairman, when we have a $2.7 billion deficit, and that is within our statutory powers, yes.
So you think that is a wise thing to do as Commissioner of Finance?
I think it is within the powers granted.
That's not
the Commissioner.
My question.
I'm answering. It's the powers granted the Commissioner of Education and the and within the power of the Commissioner of Management and Budget.
Okay, Commissioner, I'll just ask.
And
I support it. Do you think it's wise? I see you support it. I want to know whether you think it's wise.
I think that, Mr. Chairman, the property tax recognition shift and the school shift have served as a cushion in bad budget times. We've used it before. We used it
in 2002. The legislature has used it. Please.
We, meaning the state of Minnesota, 2002 and 2003.
Do you recognize there's three branches of government, Commissioner?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, you know, again, we can get back to, I mean, we could talk about the school shift and the property tax recognition shift, or we can talk about the powers of unallotment. It's our view, as we have discussed in the previous hearing as well as this one, that we are within the bounds of the statute as passed in the late 1930s, and you don't. And there's a disagreement.
We understand there's a disagreement. I'm not going to belabor this, but I am passing. Now, I looked up the definition of mimic because you have often used the word, as the governor has, that you're going to mimic the legislative authority to implement this. And I just think it's interesting that make-believe, simulated, mock, ridicule. I just think sometimes you look at the roots of words, and the fact that you're going to mimic something that somebody else has the authority to do, Commissioner, I think I will tell you straight up, I think that reflects on the professionalism of the agency. I absolutely do. And I must tell you, Commissioner, on a personal basis, that I question in the future whether I'm going to vote for a political appointment to the top job of Commissioner of Finance or Revenue ever again. Because in my mind, that's a professional job to be done by professionals, not politicians. I'll move on. I don't want to belabor the point. Okay? But we do see here that we can work with the governor, with the commissioner, your $4.4 billion 12-13, that will be your legacy to the state. And if you add the GMAC tails of some number, somewhere between $0 and $800 million, that would add to that. It is clear that your mimicking of the property tax recognition shifts means that is truly a $600 million cut. That will never be repaid. That will never be repaid under this mechanism. It just won't be. You are not even counting that as ever being repaid. Are you? It's my understanding that when you've calculated your number, you're not counting that $600 million as ever being repaid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, we have the 4.427.
Without the 600 million?
Everything else under, we didn't add, I mean, we could easily add onto the 4.4 the fact that we assume, since you have supported the school shift legislatively, that at some point that will happen before 12 and 13 ends. I could have put on our sheet a little asterisk that 4.4 is really 3.3.
Commissioner.
But it's not statute, and everything you have listed under there is not statutory.
Okay. Commissioner, that is the point. That is the point. So you say the 4.4, you do not anticipate the $600 million ever being paid back.
We paid it back after 2003.
No, Commissioner. On the sheet,
on the sheet.
Commissioner, you can't have it both ways. You can't say it's one thing and then say
no. I'm not, Senator. It is on the way we calculate it. It carries on in perpetuity, so it's not paid back, just like it was legislatively.
So then why don't you have $5 billion instead of $4.4? You gave us the number $4.4 billion in your memo.
No,
You said your calculation as Commissioner of Finance is the 4.4
yes.
billion. That does not include the 600 million. Correct.
Right, because it carries forward in perpetuity. Well, everything, you know.
Okay, exactly. You don't intend to pay it back. There's no intent on your part as a sitting finance commissioner that that $600 million ever be paid back because you want to use the 4.4. If you are, if you do intend to pay it back, then you have to use $5 billion. Correct? I mean, that's just a mathematical issue.
Well, yeah. If you want to carry it in the tails when you get to 12 and 13 and the money's there, you pay it back.
But
like
the
we
use
did
of,
in 04 and
okay,
05
commissioner,
and 06.
But you're, commissioner, you're using the 4.4, so you obviously don't believe you have the mechanism or the authority or anything to pay that back. I'm not talking about the 1.1 payment shift. I'm talking about the recognition shift, which by you telling us that your estimate of the 12-13 is $4.4 billion as an agency, that's what you told us in your memo. That says that $600 million is never going to be paid back.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, it would be our intent to pay it back when the state recovers, whether
so
it's 12 and 13 or beyond,
okay, so
just
we can,
like we did in 2000,
okay.
After the 2003.
Commissioner, how do you implement that? You're going to have the next commissioner change the accounting shift back. You're going to cook the books the other way next time when you're not here? How do you do that?
I would assume, Mr. Chairman, that it would be the same, just like after the 2002 and 3 shifts that we paid, they were
no.
paid back.
Commissioner, that was under legislative grant of authority with an automatic repayment.
Wow.
That is not what we're dealing with here now. You know that. There is no automatic repayment here. There is no authority to do this. So do you? Do you want the $600 million as part of the 4.4 or not? Because I either want to use your 4.4 and you're never going to pay the 600 back, or I want to use $5 billion and say you think you're going to pay the 600 back. Which way do you want to play it? Can't have it both ways.
Mr. Chairman, I have no. In the past, it has been a bipartisan agreement that the school shift and the property tax recognition shift get paid back when times
are. And Commissioner,
good.
Under what bipartisan agreement are you doing this right now? You're for
Mr.
bipartisanship
Chairman,
next week, but not this week?
Mr. Chairman, you finished the legislative session. You didn't balance the budget, and that's what we're doing.
Commissioner, that is not true.
Commissioner, you in your own testimony today said we balanced it with 8 minutes left. You today said
right.
that yourself.
Right.
So, Commissioner, I don't want to belabor this.
But it didn't get signed.
Commissioner, absolutely it didn't
it's
get signed.
It's your fault.
Commissioner, do you want the $600 million? Is it your intent and the governor's intent to have that $600 million repaid someday? Or is it not? Because when you gave us the $4.4 billion, the clear indication was you did not intend
Mr. Chairman, our numbers reflect that goes on in perpetuity.
Okay, thank you. Now, let's go to the $1.1 billion, because here's the point I want to make about that.
Because I notice you don't have that on your sheet, that might get paid. That
well, that's
you
because
have
it's
other...
in your $4.4 billion. The $1.1 is in your $4.4, Commissioner. So you do anticipate that somebody will pay that back. And now, Commissioner, what I'm asking you is, do you believe there is authority to appropriate $1.1 billion after you and Governor Plenty have left? Do you think that money just automatically would be paid to school districts, or will somebody have to pass a law and have it signed to pay back the $1.1 billion one-time money that is lost during this biennium?
Mr. Chairman, the statute, the unallotment statute, grants the governor the ability to defer payments.
I agree that he's deferring it, if you want to use that rhetoric. I think it's word games, but let's say you're doing
it. It's not rhetoric. It's in the statute.
Okay. So with that deferral, is there any way under that deferral, and when Governor Plenty leaves office, is there any way for that $1.1 billion to be repaid today without legislative action?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's...
And gubernatorial signature.
Mr. Chairman, it's an open and standing appropriation.
Not the 1.1 that you cut this biennium. The next 90-10 is open and standing. The next biennium is open and standing, not the 1.1 that you're cutting now. And our concern, Commissioner, we believe you do not only believe, we think it's clear there is no authority to repay that without legislative action and a gubernatorial signature. Our concern is that If you are somewhere between $4 billion and $7 billion in debt, there's no way anybody's going to pay, regardless of who the governor is, there's no way they're going to pay back the 1.1. It's not going to happen. That's our concern, because it's not automatic. If there had been a signature to an unallotment, or if there had been a signature to a shift, which you keep referring to, if this wasn't mimicking, but if this was the real thing that the legislature had bipartisanly agreed to with the governor, then there would have been an automatic repayment. That would have been the first dollar out the door. But under this circumstance, there's no automatic repayment, and I would argue, and this is conjecture, that if you've got a somewhere between $4 and $7 billion deficit when you come back, when somebody comes back in 12, it absolutely is not going to be paid back. Absolutely not. So I think under any scenario, the school districts, in my judgment, any school district that believes that this is temporary, this one time, they are out $1.7 billion. They are never going to get this money back because the money is simply not going to be there. I mean to say that publicly. It's just my opinion, but I want every school district to hear me. I chaired the committee. Took our committees 5 or 6 years to pay back the previous one that was done under legislative authority. Without any legislative authority, I don't see a legislature or a new governor ever having the ability to pay this back. Again, my opinion. But, Commissioner, as someone who, as a chair of a committee, did balance the books in education, on this point, I think I might have a little more credibility than you on this one. Other points? Okay, let's pass out a draft resolution before we take a little testimony.
Can I ask a question?
David, Senator Tomasoni, yes. We're going to pass out a draft resolution that the commission's going to consider in the next few minutes. While we do that, we're going to have Senator Tomasoni ask a few questions. Then we have a few quick testifiers, very quick.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if these are the correct commissioners to answer this question, but I do have a homeless prevention program in my committee, and can you tell me how much the governor expects homelessness to increase with the cuts to general assistance, medical care, emergency general assistance, emergency supplemental aid, group residential housing? It seems to me that all of these will affect that particular program, and I'm wondering if you have an idea of how much homelessness might increase as a result of this program also, of all these cuts.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, remember that some of the emergency funds that are being reduced by unallotment, actually there are other programs through other state agencies. They're not through the same door. But I can't speak to the total of what you might anticipate would cause homelessness based on a GAMC resident not receiving general assistance medical care, which is not even, while it's accelerated through unallotment, you're talking about the line item veto, I think, on general assistance, which is the, you know, which makes $200 million of unallotment fairly dwarfed compared to the $381 million line item.
Well, and Mr. Chair and Commissioner, there's several other programs, too, that might affect that, and I'm just wondering if homelessness wasn't even calculated in what's going on here, because it seems to me that complicates the problem of job loss and everything else we're talking about here today. But Mr. Chairman, one more comment that I just have to make,
Senator Tomasoni,
because several people have alluded to this. As I went through the various letters, and one of them was to you, Commissioner, from Senator Berglund, and I read some of the things that are in some of these letters. The governor is changing eligibility policy in a way that conflicts with state law. Setting a limit that is below statutory limit would clearly conflict with state law and would be a violation of the intent of the legislature. In another spot, while the governor has the authority to reduce payments to managed care plans, he does not have the authority to repay them above what is specified in statute. And then from Representative Lemcheski's letter, what is the legal authority for rewriting aid formulas? What is the legal basis for changing the percentage of rent? All of these questions that came from the legislature, I don't know if they were addressed in the responses and the letters from the commissioners, but it seems to me that there's a clear question as to whether or not the governor has all of the authority to do what he claims he's doing. And boy, with the outlook on UI claims actually looking better than they have in recent past, and now we're going to increase job loss through this program, it just seems to me the prudent thing to do is what Senator Berglund just suggested, as to delay the unallotment, at least until the November forecast, so that we can find out whether or not the economy is turning around. Because to cut jobs willy-nilly right now in this particular climate, the economic climate, is not the right thing to do. And I think, based on all of these things, that the constitutional relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch is definitely being violated. And I would hope that if the governor doesn't decide to at least wait until the November forecast, that somebody initiates a lawsuit so that we can put an injunction on these delays, because there is no indication right now that this particular unallotment action is necessary at this time.
Okay, thank you. We have three commissioners. Thank you, Mr. Scholter. We have three people that are going to testify briefly before we take up the resolution. Vicki Fromm, I apologize if I have that wrong, and then Mr. Miller, and then Mr. Carney. Vicki is somebody else.
Yes.
Identify yourself, please.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, my name is Joe Cuoco. Unfortunately, Vicki Fromm's not able to be here today. I'm a representative of the Association of Supportive Living Residents here in the Twin Cities area, which we are funded by the GRH, the Group Residential Housing Program. We do wish to express our concern about the additional 5% cut in the service rates to the GRH facilities, special supplementary services. That would impact the 4,300 people we deal with, we service monthly. We already suffered a 2.58% reduction to our service rate during the regular session, and all of the facilities scrambled to deal with that. But the additional 5% cut that's being weighed here would be fatal to a lot of us. Over 90% of our residents are age blind and disabled, listed as that by the standards of the Social Security. And if our settings were not available to these persons, they would have nowhere else to go but to the hospitals, correctional facilities, unfortunately, and such. And any savings that the governor thinks is going to happen with this unallotment will not happen, because those other facilities are going to be a lot more than the price that it costs for them to come to our facility. We do not have the luxury that the governor does to do a cut. Anytime we let someone go, it's not a statistical number. It's not a 1/6 of 1/8%. To us, it's family, it's friends. The residents consider us friends, family. We're their last hope. And the 5% will do some major damage to our facilities. We're not these large institutions that can maybe handle more of a budget cut like this. We are smaller facilities that are reaching out to the most vulnerable people in the state of Minnesota. And we strongly believe that this is a penny-wise and pound-foolish move, that any hope of projected savings is just not going to come about, because anyone that we're going to force to say, no, we can't service you, or we have to let go for employment reasons, is going to come back to the state in a grander fold than what the governor thinks he's going to do with this unallotment move. So I do thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Mr. Miller? Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, thank you. My name is Jim Miller, and I'm the executive director of the League of Minnesota Cities. And I want to just briefly share with you what we believe will be the impact of the governor's intended unallotment. First, I want to begin by publicly thanking Commissioner Innes for his openness to, or his willingness to meet with us, and his openness to listening to the concerns that we and all of the other constituency groups representing local government put before him, because as bad as this unallotment proposal is, we truly believe it would have been far worse based on the governor's original proposal had it not been for Commissioner Innes and his staff and their willingness, again, to hear the concerns that we had. That said, there's no way to describe what's about to happen to local governments other than to say that the unallotments will have very, very serious impacts on local governments across the state of Minnesota. To put it in a little bit in perspective, in 2010, where the more severe cuts will be experienced in local government aid and market value homestead credit loss, that will represent about 21% of the cut of aids and credits in 2010. By comparison, the amount of aids and credits in the state budget equals 4%. So we feel that the amount of cuts is totally disproportionate to the amount of money in the budget that is being looked at for solving the deficit. Another way to look at it, really, I suppose, is when you look at employment. I mean, it's important, I think, to understand that this is not just a one-time event. We had the unallotment in December of last year, and in 2003 and 2004, we lost another $192 million of AIDS, or $300 million, rather, in AIDS, $311 million. Cumulatively, those cuts are having an impact to this very day. If you look, for example, at employment at the local level, and the most recent numbers we have are 2008 numbers, so they don't reflect what happened in December of last year or what's going on right now. But employment in cities in the state of Minnesota is down 9% at the end of 2008 compared to 2002, the year before the cuts. So the point, I guess, of that is even during the time intervening between the 2003 cuts, cities have not fully recovered from the effects of that significant reduction in AIDS. I mentioned that I think the cuts will have impacts on not cities, because they really are the conduit for what's going to happen, but on the citizens of Minnesota that live in our communities in two ways. One will be an increase in property taxes that you've talked about this morning, and I won't belabor that, but the other really is in service cuts. We've had something like 1,200 responses from our 854 member cities about what they're doing or they're intending to do, largely in contemplation of what the governor was finally going to announce. But let me just share one story with you. It's the story of Coon Rapids, and I didn't pick it because they're the most extreme example. I think in many ways they're very representative. Here's what the city of Columbia Heights is doing. And in 2009, they're going to lose $300,000, and in 2010, almost $700,000 under the governor's proposals. They have, union workers have agreed to a two-week unpaid furlough. They've cut the fire department by $78,000, including paid on-call shifts, a clerk typist, reduced overtime training pay, and reduced purchasing equipment and supplies. They've cut the police department by $175,000, including eliminating hiring another police officer and a crime prevention specialist. They've cut community development by $50,500, including reducing professional services for projects and eliminated a secretary. They've cut public works by $185,000, including eliminating seasonal staff, leaving maintenance positions open, et cetera. They've cut the library by $93,000 by reducing hours from 60 to 51 and reducing a number of purchases. They've cut administration by $72,500. They've left two finance department positions open. Council members are going to donate on a voluntary basis almost 4% of their salaries. They are discontinuing their civil emergency response team effective January 10th. My point in telling you this litany, or giving you this litany of what the city of Coon Rapids has done, is to hopefully graphically portray what cities in Minnesota are doing and the effect that it's going to have on the citizens that live in our communities. We are no longer talking or speculating about cutting funding at the margins. We are cutting core services, and that will be indeed the result of what's going to happen when the unallotment is experienced by our cities. I'll end by saying that I think in some ways perhaps the most significant piece of the discussion that I hope gets revisited in the next legislative session and thereafter is how do we as local governments work with you and indeed the governor's office to restore the partnership that was so critical to providing services to the people that live in our communities for so many years and made Minnesota the state it has been for all of those decades. We're very concerned that partnership that we all call the Minnesota Miracle no longer exists. And I think if we're really going to ensure the future for the people that follow us, we have to figure out a way to reinvigorate that and make it meaningful for the people that live in our communities. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. It's interesting that 9% reduction in local government employment since 2000. That kind of
yes, sir.
8.2% unemployment in the state. So you've local governments have done their share.
Proportionately, yes, sir.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Mr. Carney, please. And while you're coming up, Commissioner, I'd ask whether on this local government, is it factual that Minneapolis has been cut 43% in the last 5 years in local government aid? Is that a fact? So that is an accurate figure? Thank you, Commissioner. 43% in 5 years. Mr. Carney, very briefly, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am particularly concerned about one aspect of this, and that is
Mr. Carney,
could you say your name, please?
Yeah, Bob Carney, Minneapolis. I'm particularly concerned about one aspect of this, and that is the proposed cut of the campaign finance refund and a related cut, potentially related cut, and that is the refund or the tax credit for renters. My concern is that with particular reference to the campaign finance refund, that is a tax refund. And if an individual complies with the law on that, and it's part of the tax law, it's their money. They're entitled to it. And I think it would be a very dangerous precedent if Governor Plenty were to succeed in trying to unallocate this, to say that a governor could unilaterally, in effect, seize or confiscate tax refunds. There's also a provision in the allotment law that allows the commissioner to consider other sources of revenue. I don't see anything to prevent a future governor from deciding to unallocate, as an example, all tax refunds to every family with an income of more than $75,000 a year. That's certainly a usurping of legislative authority. I brought this to the attention of a Minneapolis Republican ward endorsing convention yesterday. And after considering that, they voted a resolution that calls on Governor Pawlenty to reconsider this and to state unequivocally that he will not attempt to unallocate any tax refund due to any Minnesota taxpayer that's provided by law. Okay. I've also met with an attorney of a large class action law firm in Minneapolis last week. I have a legal memo right here from them indicating that I would personally have standing and that there would be standing for a class to sue if Governor Pawlenty does not relent on this. And I think it needs to be studied with regard to the rent credit. But the point is that, you know, I personally am in favor of the policy of the campaign finance refund. But beyond that, this is a different legal situation than any appropriation or tax policy because it isn't a right of individuals to their tax refund.
Okay.
So I want to draw your attention to that. And I hope that the commissioner will reconsider it and Governor Pawlenty will reconsider it. I'd be happy to give you a copy of a resolution for you to go on record of that, and I hope that you will have more meetings. My understanding is that any two of you can call another one of these meetings, right? We got to keep doing this.
Mr. Carney, thank you. And for those who would like to follow up on Mr. Your website is www.republicancontract.com.
A little poster on this,
okay.
Too.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Carney, for taking the time
thank
to come
you.
Over. Really appreciate it. Okay, Commissioner and others, have you had a chance to look at the draft resolution, Madam Speaker?
Mr. Chair, because I believe, and I think many of us believe, that Governor Pawlenty's unallotments will result in more job losses and more unemployment, a bigger deficit in the future of our state, higher property taxes, the loss of educational opportunity for our kids, the loss of health care for Minnesotans. Governor Pawlenty's unallotments move us in the wrong direction, and therefore I move the resolution LAC 0001 before the commission for a vote. And Mr. Chair, if either you or Mr. Watson would feel comfortable reading the resolution, I think that'd be important for the public.
I guess we can do that. So the speaker has moved LAC 001. Mr. Watson, could you read it, please?
Resolution LAC 0001, a legislative advisory commission resolution relating to allotments, providing recommendations on allotment reductions proposed June 16, 2009 as amended June 25 and 29, 2009, for the biennium ending June 30, 2011. Whereas, on May 18, 2009, the 86th legislature adjourned its regular session after having passed and sent to the governor bills that would have provided for a balanced general fund budget for the biennium ending June 30, 2011. And whereas, on May 21, 2009, Governor Tim Pawlenty vetoed Laws 2009, Chapter 179, House File Number 2323, which would have raised almost $1 billion in revenue for the 2010-2011 biennium, and whereas on June 16, 2009, in accordance with Minnesota Statute Section 16A.152, Subdivision 4, Commissioner of Management and Budget Tom J. Hansen proposed allotment reductions and administrative actions of $2.675 billion for the general fund for the 2010-2011 biennium, and whereas on June 18, 2009, the Commissioner of Management and Budget appeared before the Legislative Advisory Commission to explain and answer questions about his proposal, and whereas on June 25, 2009, and again on June 29, 2009, the Commissioner of Management and Budget notified the Legislative Advisory Commission of various changes to his June 16 proposal, and whereas the proposed allotment reductions are unprecedented in that no previous governor created the need for allotment reductions by vetoing a balanced budget tax bill before the biennium began, and whereas the proposed allotment reductions are unprecedented in that they are nearly 10 times the previous record amount set by Governor Tim Pawlenty in 2003, and whereas the proposed allotment reductions do nothing to reduce the projected $5.8 billion deficit for the 2012-2013 biennium, since they provide neither revenue increases nor spending reductions for future years, and whereas the Commission desires to provide the Commissioner of Management and Budget and Governor Tim Pawlenty with its recommendations, which are advisory only. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Advisory Commission of the State of Minnesota that it would be unwise and not in the interest of the state's long-term fiscal stability for Governor Tim Pawlenty to approve the allotment reductions and administrative actions proposed by Commissioner of Management and Budget Tom J. Hansen on June 16, 2009, as amended on June 25 and 29, 2009.
Questions? Discussion?
Who can vote? Go.
Okay, now, we will call the roll, and it will only be of the members who are official members, and that's Finance Committee people. So the tax chairs are not official members of the commission. We do appreciate you taking the time to go through this every meeting, and so anybody who is a finance chair affected by these unallotments, which I believe includes all of the chairs, Senator Clark, you also do not have
and
a vote.
And the majority there cannot.
And Representative Cernich does not have a vote. I think on line 22, that should say 5.9 now, based on the new budget sheet here.
That amended?
The speaker incorporates that 5.9 as opposed to 5.8. Okay, the clerk will take the roll.
Speaker Kelleher?
Aye.
Representative Solberg?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Senator Pogemiller?
Aye.
Senator Berglund?
Aye.
And Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
How many?
6 ayes.
6 ayes, 0 nays. Okay. The resolution is adopted. And Commissioner, we hope you would forward that to the Governor.
Sure will.
Matter of fact, you have to attest that we did this as secretary. So,
saw it happen.
I wanted to just point out, I'm going to pass out a sheet of objections that I have to the process and the reasons for it. It's a partial list. It's not a total list. It's just, as one of the co-chairs of the commission, I wanted that out in writing so that there was no uncertainty about why I was willing to vote for something I believe this important. I do believe this is a historic moment we just went through. We have not seen something like this in the history of the state. I certainly hope it's not a precedent. Representative Cernich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And being unable to vote is a curious situation, but it is one that is faced not just by myself and Senator Clark, but many other legislators at this point because the governor has chosen to go it alone and, I believe, abuse power. I have no authority to do anything about that today, but so do many other legislators do not have that authority, and most, if not all, Minnesotans. I just want to be clear on the record, once the rhetoric starts flying after this meeting, that there were other options, as Representative Marquardt spoke of before. There was the balanced solution that was passed by the legislature, which we now, once again, if we move past the rhetoric, know would have been better for the long-term fiscal stability of this state. But we also, I don't want the rhetoric to show that Republicans wanted to cut and Democrats did not, because I want to remind the public that Democrats proposed even more cuts, and cuts within this administration, cuts with out-of-state travel for this administration, cuts to the bureaucracy of our government. We endorsed many of the proposals that our own labor unions, those that work in the trenches, that know where other cuts could happen, proposed to us. We endorsed those that Governor Pawlenty chose not to do and instead chose to cut education and health care, raise property taxes, and cut jobs. I think this is pretty black and white today. If you look just on its face, Governor Pawlenty is choosing to unallot and cut more jobs than the legislature chose to do in their proposals. That alone should say that Governor Pawlenty is going in the wrong direction. It is a sad, sad testament to the state that one person, and I don't care if it is Governor Pawlenty or even if it was Governor Perpich, could try to assume this much power over the people's money. It is a sad state, and I hope somebody does something about it.
Okay, I would ask people to notice a letter to the editor in the Tribune today by Eve Webster, Northfield, Minnesota. It's in the Star and Tribune, 6:30:09. It happened to be in the morning paper. I thought it succinctly stated what perhaps our task might be in the future. The meeting is adjourned. Commissioner, thank you very much.